And it's time now for Solidarity Not Charity, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Welcome on this Sunday. Our topic today is going to be a discussion of Black August, since we are in the month of August, and that is a very significant month in the African liberation struggle. And as our regular listeners know, and to our new listeners, Solidarity Not Charity is the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We want to thank the African People's Socialist Party for giving us this hour each week to discuss issues of organizing solidarity from the white community under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party in solidarity with the African Liberation Movement and the International African Revolution. In the studio today, I'm Sandy Thompson, and with me is African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess. Uhuru, Penny.
Uhuru, Sandy.
So we want to talk today about Black August, because people may or may not be familiar. Of course, if you listen to Africa Live, excellent program that is hosted by Nyabinga Zimbabwe earlier today, he also spoke about Black August and played some incredible clips by Marcus Garvey. And we want to talk some more and let our listeners know just what Black August is all about, why that is seen as such a significant month in the African liberation movement. So what is Black August?
Uhuru. Well, it's great to be here as always. And as you said, that is kind of the theme for today. You know, as you talked about, Nubinga's show, Africa Live, talked about that too. But I think it's really important for us as North Americans, as white people, to talk about this as well. And Black August is really the a sort of, I guess you would say, commemoration in a way by African people of the month of August of all the hundreds of years of struggle and resistance that have taken place, resistance to the enslavement of African people and colonialism and the conditions that African people face under U.S. and Western domination. And so much of it has taken place in August. And, you know, it's really amazing to look at and to see, and I think that it's important for us to see because African people's history is a history of resistance. And just to look at some of the things that happened in August alone is so powerful and amazing. So we're going to talk a little bit about each thing, but also want to mention that Marcus Garvey, who we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute, actually declared that August 31st should be an international African holiday for African people around the world. So, you know, it was pretty well recognized all around the world that struggle happened in August, and in some cases on the same day. August 21st in particular is a very, very important day. So we have some clips today, and we're going to talk about some of these various examples of resistance and this powerful history that's so moving and, you know, and important to hear.
Well, August is a special month, and why don't we just begin to talk about some of the things, some of the occurrences within the resistance movement of African people that took place in the month of August that gave this month a special significance in the African struggle, going back to the very earliest times of the enslavement of Africa, the capture of African people to bring to the U.S. to serve as free labor, to build up the economy of the West and of white society, going back to the very earliest capture and enslavement of African people by Europeans. There was resistance, of course, from the very beginning. Can you talk about some of the early resistance actions that took place that gave special significance to the month of August?
Well, first of all, the sort of commemoration of Black August often begins with August 1619, and that was the first time that enslaved African people were forcibly brought to the shores of the United States, and that was to Jamestown, Virginia. Of course, as we know, African people had been enslaved by Europe since the 1440s and 1450s. So, you know, this was almost 200 years later. They had already been in Brazil and in the Caribbean for a couple hundred years prior to this, but they were brought to Jamestown, Virginia in August of 1619, and it was originally a Portuguese ship that had captured about 50 or 58 African people. And that ship was attacked by a Dutch ship, and that ship was attacked by an English ship, which then brought them to Virginia. And I just think that alone is telling, because it was a period in history when Holland, Portugal, and England were fighting over the most important commodity in the world, which was African human beings. And they were, you know, having these battles and what they called pirates, and which was independent businessmen, all kinds of things on the seas to try to capture this trade. It would be like the United States invading Iraq today to get the oil, or, you know, or setting up the situation in Georgia with the neocolonialists and forcing you know, this whole situation where Russia had to defend itself and fight against this U.S.-backed thing, again, for oil and natural gas coming through the Caucasus that the U.S. wants. It's the same thing, only then, instead of it being oil or uranium or diamonds or anything else, it was African human beings. That was what the stock market revolved around. That's what the economy of the U.S. was built on.
I think it's really important to bring that out, because the significance of the theft of the resources and the human beings of Africa is so central to the establishment of the wealth and dominance of the white Western world, you know, over the entire world. But it's really swept under the rug. I mean, it's really disregarded. And, of course, the Uhuru movement has led a struggle to make the demand for reparations, the popular demand on the ground throughout the African communities, and that's really central to our responsibility as white people in this country if we want to right the wrongs and set the world and join with the rest of humanity, is to support that demand for reparations, because that is the central, the theft of African labor is the central factor in building up the wealth of the white world. And as you saying, it's evidenced by the fight that the European countries and that the white world makes with each other, that we're fighting against each other for control over that most precious resource.
Yes, I think it's interesting. I'm reading a book by a Russian man who was born in Russia and lived many years in Russia, but he's lived in the United States for quite a long time. And he's writing a book. He has a book out comparing the collapse of the Soviet Union to what he's saying it will be like in the collapse of the United States. And, you know, it's not really a highly politicized book in any way, but, you know, he compares the two societies and how ill-equipped white, parasitic white people are going to be to deal with getting down to, like, living off the land or whatever it is that, you know, that we have to do to live like the rest of the world does now. And at one point in the book, he says, you know, making this comparison, he says, well, you know, America is built on the enslavement of African people and the genocide of the indigenous people. And I just think that's really interesting, because I see that more. I see that more, you know, this understanding that the Uhuru movement, the African People's Socialist Party, has been putting out for so long is beginning to seep into the consciousness of people, of North Americans, of so-called socialists and leftists, unlike in previous times. They're starting to have to admit that, because I think that everything that is happening now in the world validates that its beginnings, that validates capitalism's beginnings. In other words, people around the world are fighting for their resources, their land. The U.S. can't, and Europe can't just come in and steal anything that they want anymore. People are fighting back, and it leads you back to the beginning of that, which is, you know, which is the founded on slavery and genocide.
So you mean it exposes the true beginnings?
Yeah.
That were That's right. Invalid in any humane look at the question. Well, the chairman has also talked about how Central Africa is going forward, how the U.S. is looking to Africa to save itself from the economic crisis that the U.S. economy and Western economy finds itself in. But yet, in one of the books that I know you've been talking about and I started to read as well, Second Chance by Brzezinski, that one of the key Barack Obama advisors and a former national security advisor to President Carter, talks about a future of how to, a particular strategy he's putting forward of how to maintain U.S. dominance over the world. And he just doesn't even consider Africa as a contender on the world scene for power and for, you know, exerting influence or for even being able to thrive and grow from its own resources. And it's just mind-blowing because just even on an objective level, you look at Africa being the birthplace of all civilization and the tremendous resources and leadership that Africa historically played in the development of the world, you know, to brush that to the side, it's almost telling. It's kind of like our local newspaper, the St. Pete Times, that wants to brush to the side any evidence that would bolster the African demands and the African struggle, because what a threat it presents to the status quo for African people to be organized and to reclaim their own resources.
Right. I mean, one of the things that Brzezinski says in his book is that colonialism requires a passive, subjected people. And, you know, which is really foul and vicious to say, but all they have to do to get back to this Black August issue is look at the history of African resistance. And they will know, you know, that they're going to have a huge fight in Africa. And that's what the party's doing, building the African Socialist International. But just to get back to the question of Black August, in 1791, August 21st, was the beginning of the African uprising that became the revolution in Haiti. Haiti was the first independence movement of colonized and enslaved African people in the world. It was ultimately led by Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines and was the inspiration for resistance and revolutionary struggle, not only of African people, but leaders throughout Latin America and South America. Simon Bolivar, many others looked to the Haiti Revolution because, you know, when Haiti won the revolution and kicked out the English, kicked their asses, and Napoleon, the French, and defeated Napoleon's army, they made the independent African government made Haiti open to any people around the world, including Europeans, to come there to escape terror and any kind of oppression by government. So people came from around the world for that.
And just a few years after that was Gabriel Prosser's rebellion in Virginia. Can you say something about that?
Well, yeah, Gabriel Prosser, and it would be really, Virginia has so much, and of course, I guess maybe partly because it was the first place the Africans were brought, but in the year 1800, on August 30th, Gabriel Prosser waged a powerful rebellion in Virginia, and supposedly it was the first rebellion of enslaved Africans in the U.S. I very much doubt that is true, but it was certainly one of the earliest really well-organized and big ones, because Prosser had built an army of 1,000 African people with the goal of building an independent Black state. So, you know, that's really powerful, because all throughout history have been kind of two tendencies, two trends in the African liberation movement, one of them towards integration and neocolonialism, and one of them for African independence and the right to control their own land, return to Africa, have Africa's resources, and have independence as a people. One of Gabriel Prosser's army stated, "I would kill a white man as freely as a cat." So, needless to say, the white people were very scared after that.
I want to let our listeners know, if you would like to participate in this discussion about Black August, if you have questions or comments, feel free to phone us. If you're on Skype, the Skype ID is Uhuru Radio. If you are listening in the U.S. and you would like to call in, participate in the discussion, the number is 727-565-1599. If you're in the U.K., the number is 440-208-133-6629. And you can also email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Also want to remind our listeners that if you are going to be leaving from your computer, you want to continue to listen in as you drive around or wherever you are, you can listen over your telephone. In the U.S., well, you can get all these phone numbers on uhururadio.com, but in the U.S., there are a couple of phone numbers, one of which is 515-489-1670. There are also phone numbers in the U.K. and two numbers in South Africa, are also known as Occupied Azania, in Cape Town and Johannesburg. So many ways to listen to uhururadio.com, and, of course, the archives are available to download at your convenience. But feel free to join in this discussion. So not too long, about 30 years after Gabriel Prosser's rebellion in Virginia, was probably the more well-known uprising led by Nat Turner.
That's right. Nat Turner was also in Virginia. He led a brigade of 50 African people with orders to kill all whites. They killed 57 white people, including women and children of slave-owning families. But it's interesting that Turner said he spared some poor white people because he said they hated themselves more than they hated African people. So, I mean, I just think that's interesting because there's that whole oppressed Southern poor white cracker, you know, kind of thing, which instead of standing with Africans, have always worked in the interest of their own oppressors, white power, to carry out oppression against Africans. So, but the humanity of Nat Turner is really, you know, is really profound in that. One of the people that he killed, well, this family, he killed a family of 10 children. And it was a slave-owning family of a man named Levi Waller. So he could well be, and probably was, you know, maybe one of the plantation owners where the chairman, Omalia Shetela, who was born with the name Joseph Waller, came from, because I know that Fats Waller, the musician, was from this line.
Very large plantation.
It was very large plantation, or that family had it. Right, you know, this family was wiped out. But, you know, but I think that it's really important because, again, white people were scared to death. But it's war. It's resistance. And it shows that none of us are innocent, mm-hmm. not even the children. We all live on this pedestal that requires this profound oppression and just ripping apart of any kind of life for African people, any kind of dignity, any kind of self-determination, or their land, their language, their families. They were tortured. And, you know, this is what had to happen. It was war. And how many millions of Africans were slaughtered by this?
Well, and it shows that there can be no peace or security on a foundation of genocide. So you see all the calls for, you know, fight the terrorists or more police, more security bars. It never will be enough so long as the oppression is there, the resistance will be there.
That's right. And, you know, I read that white people were so scared that if they heard the cat walking downstairs at night, you know, they would just be, you know, get their guns out and start shooting at things. And
well, that's probably why everyone's on antidepressants now or anxiety medication.
Exactly. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Because when you, like you're saying, when we live at the expense of other people, then you've always got to watch your back. You always got to be afraid as the chairman says, that somebody's going to cut your throat because they're just trying to live and get back what is rightly theirs. And it's a war. And colonialism is war. It is terror. You talk about terrorism. What could be greater terror than the enslavement of an entire people and everything that went with that? The theft of their land, their resources, capturing them by gunpoint, keeping them in hideous camps and slave castles on the coast for months with no food, no toilets, raping women. You know, just, I mean, it's beyond comprehension.
It is. Well, during that same period of the early 1800s was the period during which Harriet Tubman operated the Underground Railroad, helping Africans to escape from slavery. And that railroad was initiated during the month of August, also in 1810.
Well, and I think it's interesting because it went on for a long time, and it wasn't just Harriet Tubman. There were many, many other people, and there were considered to be maybe 100,000 people that escaped. They had incredible escape routes, that some of which went to Canada, some of which went to Mexico, some of which went to the Caribbean islands. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing. And in fact, I've read that at least 1,000 escaped Africans lived or settled in Toronto, Canada, you know, and other parts. And it's probably much more than that, because it was probably very impossible to get a correct count, you know, on that. But I think that the Underground Railroad is really an important thing. And it came about because the resistance was so profound on the part of Africans, enslaved Africans, that it became apparent even to many white people, or white people who were part of what was called the abolition movement, that it was no longer going to be a viable system. They couldn't keep doing it because the resistance was too great, and because the worldwide opinion against enslaving a whole people was you know, growing and growing. And also, frankly, because the world, you know, imperialism was finding it cheaper to enslave people on their own land through direct colonialism. So they were moving out of enslavement. But it is important that there were a number of white people who participated in the Underground Railroad. I know my hometown in southern Indiana, which was a so-called free state, was bordering, you know, was on the Ohio River, facing Louisville, Kentucky, which was a slave state. And there, the last time I was in New Albany, there was an exhibit at the library about the Underground Railroad in that town. And it, you know, it was just really interesting to see that there were some North Americans who really fought for it and made some very profound statements and participated in it as well.
Well, then, just proceeding chronologically and touching some of the key points that took place in August that have resulted in August having a special commemorative significance in the African Liberation Movement, of course, was August 17th, which was the birthday of Marcus Garvey in 1887.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, enough could never be said about Marcus Garvey. There's tomes and volumes of books written about him. But I think that if there's any, you know, subsequent extension of that movement, it would be the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement, which is certainly the heirs to the Garvey Movement. Because, you know, I would urge all North Americans to read about the Garvey Movement. It's amazing. And it's also really, again, important for us to understand the relationship of white people to it, because white people participated in or even instigated the attack on the Garvey Movement, which destroyed it. But, you know, Marcus Garvey was born in Jamaica. He was from a family of Maroons, and you know, that's another whole show. We could just talk about the Maroons, because the Maroons were Africans who resisted. who fought, who organized and actually won land, not only in the Caribbean islands, but in the United States. In fact, I've read that the Africans who were part of the Seminoles that fought in here in Florida now call themselves Maroons because their descendants are still alive and keep that tradition going. So, you know, that's a really powerful thing.
Well, and I would encourage our listeners who might not have heard, or even if you did hear Africa Live this morning, to go and check out the archives when they become available later in the week, because Nyabinga Zimbabwe on the Africa Live program earlier today on uhururadio.com actually aired some speeches, clips from speeches by Marcus Garvey. And it was really interesting because a lot of the same stuff that Chairman O'Malley has talked about, that you've talked about and written about the history of African people, you know, Marcus Garvey was saying how the tremendous advances made in Africa at the time when Europeans were living in caves and, right. You know, he just described the contrast between the civilized advancements taking place in Africa at the time when Europeans had barely learned to master fire, and his famous slogan about up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, he built tremendous confidence and movement of African people, and it's really been, I mean, O'Malley Shatela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, has described the Uhuru movement as being in many ways a continuation and very similar to the character of the Marcus Garvey movement, because it's really grounded in the African working class. It's about building institutions and independence for African people. It's about worldwide unity, you know, like the slogan Africa for Africans at home and abroad. And if people have not had a chance to study much on Marcus Garvey, you definitely should do that, because that is a powerful, powerful man, a powerful movement, a powerful moment in history.
There's, you know, it's amazing to think about that Marcus Garvey led a movement, the United Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, that had up to 11 million members around the world. Can you imagine anything?
Chapters in 52 different countries.
Yeah, I mean, it was a consciousness that Africa belonged to. The slogan was Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. A clear anti-colonial movement and a movement for the, you know, a national liberation movement. Last week, the Uhuru House showed a film about Garvey with incredible footage. It was the first time I had seen some of that. It was really powerful to see. I mean, and women played a key role in it. There was, you know, and they had businesses. They had their own passports. It showed some of the passports. It showed, I mean, just hundreds of thousands, it looks like, tens of thousands of people marching in parades in Harlem and in New York, with children, men, women, nurses, teachers, business people. And, you know, it conveyed affluence. It conveyed prosperity. It was, and they had their own businesses, many times a network around the country, because the Garvey movement in the U.S. was not just in New York. It was in every city. They had laundries and cleaners and record companies and book publishing houses, everything. It was a nation. It was truly a nation, and it was defeated by the United States government. J. Edgar Hoover got his start in the FBI attacking the Garvey movement, and Garvey was ultimately sent to federal prison in the United States and then deported back to Jamaica, and then I think he died in England. And he was very young, really. He died when he was only about 45 or so. I mean, he built this movement when he was, I think he's still in his 20s. So he was a genius. He was brilliant. He summed up the period. He won just the hearts and minds of African people everywhere and embodied the revolutionary struggle that's still going on today. I mean, there's, like you're saying, there's not that much that's very different about what African people are struggling for today.
The documentary that you mentioned that we got to watch last week at the Sunday mass rally at the Uhuru House was produced by the African People's Socialist Party. And for our listeners, it is available on UhuruTV.com. So you can go there and watch incredible footage from the Garvey movement. We also learned during last week's rally that that one of the incredible African women leaders of the Uhuru movement today shares a birthday with Marcus Garvey.
That's
and that
right.
was International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement President Ivory Sobukwe Sadayo. So we say a belated a happy birthday to President Ivory, and want to also remind our listeners that the annual convention of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement is coming up in September. And if you are able to come to St. Petersburg for that, you are going to be so glad that you did, because it's going to be a really groundbreaking convention and a tremendous opportunity for you to see and hear the growing, emerging, and expanding, exploding movement for African liberation today. So if you want to register for that convention, you can do that on their website. It's $50 for registration, and you should definitely go and do that. It's INPDUM.org. That's INPDUM.org.
And while it's going to be amazing. Really looking forward to it.
I want to take this time here while we're talking about upcoming events to make a few announcements. It's about 30 minutes past the hour on uhururadio.com, well, 35 past the hour. And there are a number of events happening around the country that I want to invite our listeners to, that the African People's Solidarity Committee and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is organized. First off, on tomorrow afternoon in Philadelphia, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is offering a Philadelphia True African History Tour. Because, you know, every year thousands of people flock to Philadelphia to see the sites of the mythological history of the U.S. with a perspective that justifies the unjust status quo of America. But U.S. history can really only be understood through the lens of the struggles and resistance of the African working class. So the tour that is going to take place, and there is a $10 requested donation for that tour, is going to cover the first White House, where George Washington kept 9 Africans enslaved during his tenure as the first president of the U.S., locations of the African-led Underground Railroad and the major role that Philadelphia played in African resistance to slavery, a whole bunch of other very significant sites in the history of this country and the history of African resistance. So if you're interested in participating and going along on the Philadelphia True African History Tour, you want to meet up at 3:45 tomorrow afternoon at the Uhuru Solidarity Center, which is located at 3733 Lancaster Avenue in Philadelphia. For more information on that, you can phone 215-387-0919. That's 215-387-0919. And they're going to meet up at 3:45 and leave on the tour at 4 p.m. Additionally, in St. Petersburg, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is meeting each week at the Atlanta Bread Company, in the community room at Atlanta Bread Company, located downtown St. Petersburg at 179 First Avenue North in St. Pete, Florida, downtown, at 6:30 p.m. every Thursday. And that is an open meeting for anyone who wants to get involved in building support and solidarity from the white community for the African liberation struggle. And, of course, in California, in Northern California in particular, the African People's Solidarity Committee and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is in full swing of our street fair season, where there are opportunities all over the area at the Art and Soul Festival this weekend, upcoming weekend in Oakland, at the Power to the Peaceful Festival September 6th in San Francisco, Mountain View Art and Wine Festival September 6th and 7th, Monterey Jazz Festival September 19th through the 21st. You can come out, volunteer in a food booth, and concretely show your support, participate in fundraising for the Uhuru movement. Also, coming up September 6th in Philadelphia will be another occurrence of the Clark Park People's Flea Market. Everyone in Philly knows where Clark Park is in West Philly, and that flea market itself is a fundraiser for the Uhuru movement. So whether you go there and shop, whether you volunteer, or whether you rent booth space to vend your wares, you can support the African Liberation Movement. And once again, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement annual convention is at the end of September, September 27th and 28th, and you definitely should check that out. So just getting back to our discussion of Black August, where were we?
Well, there's quite a bit more to say, but I want to jump ahead a little bit because I do want to play some of the clips that we have. But I'll just sum up really quick that other things that happened in August. August 30th, 1948, birth of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois branch of the Black Panther Party, who was assassinated when he was only 21 years old, but he certainly was an amazing rising leader of the Panther Party. He was assassinated by the United States government. August 1963 was the March on Washington. That was the quote, "I have a dream." And it led to the passing of the Voting Rights Act by the U.S. government, Congress, in 1965. And it certainly was a turning point, one of the turning points from the civil rights to the Black Power movement. August 11th, 1965 was the outbreak of the Watts Rebellion in L.A. after police arrested an African man. August 1967 was the launching of COINTELPRO, the FBI program by the United States government against the African Liberation Movement. August 25th, 1967, and now, you know, we have some clips on this, was the Marin County Courthouse Rebellion led by Jonathan Jackson. As a trial was going on, the action was calling for freedom of the Soledad brothers, who included Jackson's brother, George Jackson, famous George Jackson. And the Soledad brothers were accused of killing guards in Soledad prison. So there was a trial going on, and during this trial in the Marin County Courthouse in California, Jonathan Jackson and others liberated Richelle McGee, James McLean, and William Christmas, and also took the judge, the district attorney, and three jurors as hostages. But as they were getting away, they were killed.
The guards opened fire on the entire van.
They just
blew away everyone in the van except for Richelle McGee.
Yeah, Richelle McGee, I think the judge was killed. I think four of the North Americans also survived that. But
George Jackson was just a beloved, incredible, somewhat common experience of Africans getting locked up as a result of the general attack on African rights and the unjust incarceration of African people, and then became politicized while in the prison, and just an incredible leader within the prison movement.
Well, I think it's important. He was, you know, he and his brother and that whole movement, the prison movement, was just an offshoot of the African liberation movement of the 1960s. And I think that some people want to divide that, but it was just simply so many, even then, such a huge percentage of the African population is in prison that it's just one front of the African liberation movement, and that's what he represented. So I think you have some clips.
We have a few words here from George Jackson.
Threats, terrorism, brutality. The whole thing is based on fear.
The only way the oppressor can maintain his position is by fostering, nurturing, building contempt for the oppressed. The brutality really leads to more resistance, and that's what we're working for, revolution. The institutions that buttress the establishment have to be assaulted. We're just beginning to learn, beginning to relate to each other, learn how to function together. We are aware of the fact that the opposition uses the kill off the head principle, kill the body, and we've set up safeguards against that sort of thing. Well, I could die tomorrow, but there'll be 200 or 300 people to take my place.
So that was George Jackson, organizer with the Black Liberation Struggle in the 1960s. Incredible leader, George Jackson.
Well, I didn't get to hear that, so I can't really sum that up. But I think that it's, you know, it's really important to hear him and to be able to know what a powerful movement that was. And again, George Jackson himself was assassinated about, 4 years after the Marin County Courthouse on August 21st, 1971. So again, we have so many things that happened on August 21st, from the rebellion in Haiti, from Nat Turner's rebellion, to George Jackson, the assassination. And sometimes the state does things on a certain day to give a message, and that might have been one. But it was clear that George Jackson was assassinated in San Quentin prison, and we also know that 3 guards were killed that day as well.
And then George Jackson, it was the assassination of George Jackson that on August 21st, 1971, that then prompted the prison rebellion at Attica. That was another sort of really key moment in the African liberation struggle. And we have a little bit of audio from the prisoners who were a part of the Attica prison rebellion as well.
Yeah, let me say first of all a little bit about the Attica rebellion, because yes, it was, as Sandy said, it was inspired by the assassination of George Jackson, and it was in September of 1971, but it was just a couple of weeks at most after that. It was in early September. Attica prison was horrible. It was in New York. I'm sure it still is, if, you know, all the prisons everywhere are complete dens of torture and just hell holes. But there were 1,200 prisoners in Attica who rebelled against the just brutal and inhumane conditions that they were forced to, and they had a kind of, you know, rebellion that took over the yard. They all came out in the yard, and they held quite a few guards, if not all the guards, hostage. And they held this for over 5 days. At the end of 5 days, Governor Rockefeller sent in 500 state troops who fired more than 2,000 rounds in 9 minutes. 39 people were killed, including 10 guards, 10 white guards, which is really interesting because it shows you that loyalty to white power will not necessarily save your ass. You know, so they don't care about white people either sometimes. So it's best to stand on the side of African people because they're fighting for the liberation of this earth and this planet. So I think, afterwards, after that, Rockefeller forced the survivors of that into incredible torture. They were forced to walk and crawl on broken glass. They were tortured by physical assault, burned with cigarettes. I mean, you know, it was just a hideous reign of terror against this brutal act of resistance. And I think that we could really call it, in some ways, the last battle of the Black Liberation Movement of the 60s as it was being defeated by COINTELPRO, and, you know, and leaders were being assassinated and this movement was being crushed.
Well, that's right. And the clip that we wanted to share just is one of the organizers of the liberation struggle and the African resistance movement from inside of Attica. So I want to share that with you.
We felt that the people should come together and get a better understanding of the conditions here, what was being did to them by the administration. So behind this, we would hold meetings in the yard. You know, we'd hold open house, and whoever wanted to come to listen to our political ideology, they were welcome. We didn't bar anyone. This was frowned on by the institution, and they would break it up. We start talking about a strike. They made a lot of promises about the conditions would be better, the food would get better, and medical conditions would be better. There was a lot of promises. So everyone laid, they waited, you know. And nothing was did. This is when the Attica Liberation Faction began. Things were getting worse. What really solidified things was George Jackson's death. This had a reaction on the people that we were trying to accomplish all along to bring them together. We thought of, well, how could we pay tribute to George Jackson, because a lot of us idolized him, the things that he was doing, the things he was exposing about the system. So we decided that we would have a silent fast that whole day in honor of him. We would wear black armbands. No one was to eat anything that whole day. We noted that if the people could come together for this, then they could come together for other things.
I didn't know anything about, you know, George Jackson. What George Jackson? So we were going to chow that morning, and when we got in the mess, so everything was quiet. Nobody seen nothing. And you talking about 500, 600, 700 people, inmates. Nobody was eating. So I asked one of my buddies, Carlos, I said, what's up, man? He said, shh, be cool, guy. I said, I didn't tell you, man. This dude, George Jackson, in California, killing, and man, that's some kind of solidarity. Ain't nobody eating.
So that gives some background to the organizing that was being done from inside the prison in Attica. And then we want to continue with a clip. This next clip is an African prisoner called L.D. Barkley, who is reading from the manifesto of...
Just to say, L.D. Barkley was the leader, he was a profound leader. It was a young man who led the Attica rebellion, and he was killed.
And here he is.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard of the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who enslave and exploit the people of America. Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want a governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite other people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want. We want.
Now, one of the observations. One of the observation helicopters is taken off, and with it, now for the first time, One of the large army helicopters has taken off. It is known that the army helicopters are loaded with what is called riot gas, though not quite sure what kind of gas it is. Anyway, here come the helicopters, and they are now heading for the prison. One of the large army helicopters now going overhead, over the wall, into the prison.
The next thing I know is this big helicopter flying over us, and tear gas is coming from everywhere. It's a whole lot of shooting carrying on. So naturally, everyone is running for cover, you know. So I'm next to the wall, and I know around me that everyone is hiding the face and diving and spitting rags and putting it to the nose. But what I know was troopers start coming from everywhere, but then I start seeing different people falling, you know. They were shot. Guys was losing their hands, shot in the head, necks.
They had officers lined up all in the hall, everywhere. You know, you were scared to death because you were stripped naked. All you seen and heard was a lot of nasty words. They called you all kinds of niggas, you know. They called them the black niggas. They called them the white niggas. They called them the Puerto Rican niggas and so forth, you know.
I am telling you what I seen with my own eyes. I speak of my dead brother, L.D. Barkley. I know for a fact that he was premeditatedly murdered. I know this.
I was taken out of the yard, and I was put on a table, nude. My body, at present, have cigar burns, cigarette burns all over it. My testicles at times bother me now from cigarette butts, sticks, rifles, laying on the table with my head looking up at the catwalk being spit on, hot shells thrown on my body. I tried to cover up with my pillow. Can you imagine 250 pounds getting under a pillow? State troopers and police came by and said, "Nigga, get out from under that pillow. We wanted you to have a cover. We would give you one. You gonna die in the morning, nigga, so it don't make no difference nowhere whether you freeze or we kill you. Nigga, black power, huh? Black power, huh?" That's all was said to me while I was in that room, trying to make me be the animal that he is, to reverse the victim to the criminal to the victim.
People must know that we are dying. We are being murdered every day. That is what's happening in here, in all the Atticas over the world.
So that courageous resistance of African people in Attica and in prisons all throughout the country at that time, but in Attica in particular with the Attica prison rebellion, was brutally crushed by Governor Rockefeller. And as you said, Penny, at least 39 people were killed, including the 10 guards that were there. And, you know, people were tortured, brutally tortured in the aftermath of that. And of course today, you know, the prisons have exploded, the enslaved labor that Africans are forced to participate in prisons throughout the country. It continues today, but we see the movement of resistance growing strong, and that is one of the key demands and questions that the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement has raised up in its platform, and I'm sure will be addressed in the convention coming up at the end of September, the question of freeing African people from the prisons, which are nothing more than a modern-day slave labor and a total attack on basic national democratic rights of African people. We just have a few more minutes. Do we want to sum up anything more about Black August, the significance of Black August?
Well, I think that, you know, the history is still going on, because on August 1st, the Uhuru movement, led by Diop Olubala, challenged Barack Obama, presidential candidate, here in St. Petersburg, Florida, by raising a banner and challenging him under the theme, "What about the black community, Obama?" So the struggle continues. Right. It keeps going on. and the Uhuru movement, the African People's Socialist Party, have taken up the banner that leads the resistance of African people here and around the world today. And as the chairman says, we will see victory in our lifetime. Of that, I'm very convinced. So it's in the interest of all white people to join this, to join in solidarity. And there's nothing that this dead, dying system built on brutality and violence and terror against African people and people on the planet Earth has to really give to us that's real, that's meaningful, that's going to bring peace and security for ourselves and our children. We need a new world. This world is being destroyed, has been destroyed by white power. We need black power and the power of the people around the world to control their own destiny and to bring about humanity as a united force to be able to save the planet as a whole and go forward.
Uhuru, that's right. Well, this concludes our broadcast for today. This concludes our salute to Black August, a month of heroic and heightened resistance of African people worldwide. We want to again thank the African People's Socialist Party for their tremendous leadership in forging a new world and for allowing us to participate and organize solidarity from the white community. This concludes our broadcast this week for Solidarity Not Charity. Tune in again next Sunday. Check out the archives. Subscribe to Uhuru Radio.